You are listening to the EFCA Theology Podcast, which exists to help pastors and church leaders stay passionate about the gospel and faithful to the scriptures. In 2018, EFCA pastors and church leaders gathered in San Antonio, Texas, for the annual Theology Conference. The focus of the pre-conference was on the theme, Understanding Islam, Loving Our Neighbors. On this episode of the podcast, we share a message from that pre-conference by Roy Oxnabod, Who Are the Real Muslims? Roy serves as director of Kama Network, a coalition of ministries to Muslims in North America, and Reach National All People Director of Muslim Ministry.
Just give you a little bit of an idea. Last week, I was at a school board meeting in which part of the school curriculum for 6 years old was to say that Muslims, Christians, and Jews believe and worship the same God. And then the article further went on and said that anyone who holds to a religion thinks that everybody else needs to believe that religion, and if they don't, they will go to hell. And they are the reasons why there is violence and why there's so much violence in the name of religion. And this was being taught to young 6 years old with very impressionable. So we talked about this, but there was a guy from Egypt that came and drove all the way from Florida up. He is a Muslim background, or not a Muslim, but a Christian background believer. And he gave me a CD of him speaking in churches. And the entire thing, he goes on and says that Allah is really Satan, and he shows how this is. He talks about Muslims, if they get up to become 3 to 4%, will take over a nation, and all of us will become Muslims. He went on to say that Muslims are taught in the Quran to kill people, and this is what will happen. And he just goes on and on. And then at the end, you should witness to Muslims. And as I've gone in speaking in churches, particularly in sort of the older gray crowd, there's just an awful lot of fear and a lot of understanding. And many have picked up and read books on Islam by people who are well-meaning in talking about Islam. And they come up with a binary sense of Islam that Muslims are essentially this. And if they are true Muslims, this is what they believe. And if they don't believe this, then they're not really good Muslims. So all good Muslims are this. And then they point to what is happening in Afghanistan with the bombings. They look to Boko Haram in Africa. They'll look and give up. And then we're supposed to have a Q&A time in which we talk about this. And let me just say that I have been doing Muslim ministry for over 30 years. I've never met one of them. I did meet a recruit for Hezbollah. He just was trying to get people to go back to the country and join the fight to fight against Iraq. But he wasn't out to kill anybody. He was just asked to do this, and this was sort of a job for him. So he was a recruit for Hezbollah, but he was not in anything that we would consider dangerous. There's a tremendous amount of misinformation out there about Muslims. And what I'd like to do is to try to give you a little bit of an understanding of what Muslims believe. Mike has given you sort of what you believe, but I'd like to look at sort of the many voices of Islam. And there are extremely a lot of different voices, but let me give you a little bit of the context. One of the things that Muslims are facing is that Muhammad, Islamic law, and everything that was done was to a tribal community of the Quraysh tribe in Saudi Arabia in 600 AD. The world no longer is in 600 AD. And the laws that were put out in Islam that they are supposed to follow don't work in the 21st century. And Muslims are in an absolute crisis in regards to this. What does it mean to be a Muslim in the 21st century? We have industrialization, modernization, globalization has taken place irrespective of any kind of religion. The world is passing them by, and there have been examples of countries that say, well, let's go back to the essentials, and there's something that's wrong, and let's set up a country set on these things. And then they look at Afghanistan, they look at Iran, they look at Sudan, and they go, my goodness, this takes them out of the 21st century back to 600 AD, and we don't want it. And the military comes in and says, wait a minute, stop, we can't do this. It destroys the economy of our country. It destroys everything that we are doing in our country. So Muslims are really wrestling with the whole idea of modernity and are confronted with issues that just really have no historical precedence at all for. Al-Fadl is a great jurist. He is in L.A. He has been the advisor to many presidents in regards to Islam. And he says that most Muslims don't know and cannot interpret the Quran and in light of the 21st century. And it takes jurists to do this. And there are very few jurists that understand enough of Islamic law and Islamic precedents to be able to make right interpretations. So Al-Fadl and many others would say that Osama bin Laden, Zakawi, and all these other people who, Baghdadi and others, they say these guys are not really true people who know how to understand Islam in the 21st century. They are armchair theologians. They don't speak for Islam. We, the jurists, speak for Islam, and we are the ones that can interpret things. Because this just does not work. So there's a crisis within Islam that's been created through modernization and has resulted in a variety of responses. A good friend of mine, I asked him and I said, how do you read the Quran? And he said, well, if you read it literally, you'll end up with ISIS. And he said, we have to reinterpret the Quran. We have to reinterpret everything in regards to this. We have to find what it really means to be a Muslim. In fact, we have to write a new Quran. So this whole thing has been impacted them. And the first thing is just de-Islamization within society. There's secularism of the state, political, economic, and social institutions. This has been taking place over the last century. It's not something that has happened within a very short period of time. It has gone on, particularly with colonialism. And as this has happened, Muslims have begun to see that no longer are their society Muslim any longer. For those of you who have traveled to a Muslim country, what do you see in the main capital cities of institutions? McDonald's, KFC, Nike, Levi jeans, Coca-Cola, and on goes the list. In fact, these people feel like they have been inundated by everything from the West, and there's nothing Islamic any longer in their society. And this crisis has come to them. They've seen this whole de-Islamization that has taken place, and they think that there needs to be a response to this because Islam used to be at the height of civilization when the West was in their dark ages. It was they that translated Plato and Aristotle and others. They were the ones that did mathematics. For those of you who like algebra, you have the Muslims to thank for. If you hated geometry, the Muslims are to blame. So they were in the height in regards to medicine, art, and all of these things. And then just through a process of nothing really, it just seemed to go away, and the West swept out, and they were left behind, and all of this stuff starts coming in, and they don't know what's going on. So Western dominance and the political rule, institutional changes, dependence upon the West, the whole economy. Pakistan bows to the United States because the United States is the primary financer of the country of Pakistan. They're looking to saying, well, we want to do things, but then the World Bank says, here are things that you have to do. If there are human rights violations, you've got to correct these things, or we will not give you money. We will not unblock the money that you have in these various other things. It's kind of interesting that even Saudi Arabia has now just said that because of the corruption that's going on, we've got to do something and gain control of these things, rather than having a outside Western influence do it, we're going to try to do it in-house. But it's been the political rule. It's been the military. It's the military that comes in and says to Afghanistan, to all of these other places, Iraq, we are going to come in and we're going to run your country, in essence. And this has just caused a crisis. They've lost their identity as to who they are. The whole educational system seemed to go awry, and they had what in the madrasas, which are the schools where students were taught, the Western education was far advanced from where Islam used to be, so they're now looking to the West for all of the educational type of things in universities. In fact, so much so that Saudi Arabia has sent over 90,000 Saudis to the United States to get an education in the place that gets you can get the best education, which is the United States. And they've seen this bifurcation, and their whole educational system has been reduced to just the mosque of memorizing the Quran. And then you have these clerics that come along that really think that the government is anti-Islamic, Islam only a name, and what they want to do is to bring Islam back again. But they say we've got to get rid of all of Western education influences and everything, and we have to discover what it is that is Islamic education. And we've got to get back to where we used to be, because we've lost the pride of our civilization. We've lost who we are and our identity. So this whole bifurcation of modern education and religious education, traditional education, and the religious education and the mosque education has nothing to do with the world and living in the world. And it's this modern education that is really where it is, and you have to learn English to be able to do this, or French. And there's just a crisis in regards to the educational system, which is basically oftentimes set in with rote memorization. Two renowned scholars, one that was here in Chicago, they decided in the early 1960s that they were going to establish a solid Islamic-based education in the Muslim world. So they went back to Pakistan to set this up. Within 4 years, they left and came back to the institutions here in the United States, and this is what they said. The corruption is so ingrained in our country that we can't get anything going. Number two, our students don't want to study. We can't get them to study. All they want to do is cheat. And they said the only hope for the Muslim world are the Muslims in the West. So they gave their lives here in the United States to try to get an educated Muslim community. The end result is there's just an absolute crisis that has been growing and growing and growing within the Muslim world. So the response to modernization is sort of, the big question was, we've got to recover and discover what Islam is all about, this all-embracing system that we've been told that it's all about. When the Ayatollah Khomeini came in, there was a sense of saying, well, here's where it is, because back in 1927, the Ottoman Empire, Ataturk, got rid of the caliph, and the Muslim world and rule was gone. Really, in reading some of the modern people who are writing on Islamic fundamentalism said, really, the caliph only was operable during the four rightly guided caliphs at the very beginning of Islam. And since that point in time, it's only been a figurehead, oftentimes corrupted, oftentimes non-Islamic. And they acted more like kings and princes than they did Muslim rulers. So when they got rid of the caliphate, was sort of like the pope in the Muslim world, it had long died before. And there's been this hope that if we could only discover and rediscover what it means to be a Muslim society, only then we can become players in the modern world again. So there was this understanding of what is the system. And the idea was that Islam's got to pave the new way for and counter distinction to the rest of the world. So we've got to get rid of mathematics from the Western perspective and say, what is Islamic mathematics? Let's not look at regards to chemistry taken from the Muslim, from the Western world. We've got to find a Islamic chemistry. We've got to find Islamic medicine. We have to find something in contradistinction to the rest of the world. We have to discover what we were, because we were once the ones that were the ones that were at the beginning, at the height of civilization. And it was because we were a Muslim. We've lost our identity. We've lost who we are. And therefore, we've got to rediscover what it is. And the premise is this: Islam leads to knowledge, and knowledge leads to Islam. So therefore, we have to discover what this is. Do you understand this crisis? Think of the Reformation. It was, the religious leaders are corrupt. They've added so much to it. We've got to rediscover sola scriptura. We've got to understand who we are, what our roots are, and get back to that. So also within the Muslim world. So this is the way that it has come about. I'm not too sure if you can see this real well, but up at the beginning there is Islam is cultural identity. So it's built on Tawheed, the oneness of God, Sharia, and Bidat, which is worship. So then we look at the various aspects of society. So we start over here, which is Islamic values and belief systems. We want to know what these belief systems and values are all about. There we go, we're getting much larger. We want to know what is Muslim behavior supposed to be. How are we supposed to be like a Muslim? How are we supposed to act as Muslims? We don't know. All we do is turn on TV and we see Dallas, which was back then. But I mean, it's you see all these other programming. The programming is coming from Hollywood. That's why so many of Muslims want to go to Hollywood. Then there's this whole Islamic lifestyle. And they said, well, you know, we have to be in contradistinction. Instead of walking around with jeans and everything else, what does it mean to be Muslim? So they started to put on the Islamic dress again. For the women, it was the hijab. I have a Muslim friend of mine. He said, listen, my wife's never worn a hijab. We're from Pakistan. And my daughter now wears a hijab. my son's got a beard, you know, with no mustache. And he goes, what's happened to my children? They were born in the U.S. But there is this sense of there's got to be an Islamic lifestyle, customs, the way that we have symbols and dress. We've got to do this in contradistinction to everyone else. Let me just say this. Just because a person puts on a hijab or puts on a beard does not mean that they are practicing their faith. It is more about identity than it is belief. It is to rediscover, as one person said, I'm not like my other Americans, but I don't know how I'm different, so I'm going to dress different. You see that also within the black community. We counter distinction to the rest of the world. Who are we? What are we? And how does this make us to be who we are? So there is Islamic language, music, arts, and literature. There is a whole upsurge in regards to the Arabic language. We've got to get back to this. And whereas before, it really wasn't that big a deal. There is also a sense of institution rituals, food and drink. They have now created their own Islamic Coca-Cola. So you have Western Coca-Cola, but they have Islamic Coca-Cola. There is Islamic blue jeans. There is swimsuits. Well, then you have the burkini rather than the bikini. But, I mean, it's trying to discover who we are and what we are. And for many cultures, it comes down to the food and dress, the way we express ourselves. So they're saying, in contradistinction to the rest of the world that seems to be pressing in on us from all sides, economic institutions and everything, who are we and what are we? What is our place in this world? And they don't have an answer. And there are many people who have come along to try to say what these answers are. As Islamic media, technology, innovations. Have you heard of CNN? Well, what about Al Jazeera? Al Jazeera was to be set up because they wanted to have a news channel in counterdistinction to the Western news channels. There's 24 hours. We want to do 24 hours. But we want to do it from our slant rather than from the Western slant. But again, it was this reaction to what are we and who are we? Because we feel like we have been just taken over by the rest of the world. And we don't know who we are again. And we want to know who we are. So this is what is sort of driving this whole kind of perspective. And I don't know if you can appreciate this. Muslims are going through their medieval dark ages right now, and we are experiencing it. We are seeing close to the bottom. So what has been the response? The response has been multifaceted. In regards to modernity, there's been all kinds of reactions. The only thing that you hear in Western society is possibly this group, the fundamentalists, the Islamicists. But there is an entire whole aspect of large groups of communities that have responded to the issue of modernity. So let's take a look at some of these. Top of the list, which is not necessarily because of number, but in regards to the squeaking wheel gets the grease type thing. So here we have the Islamic fundamentalists, about 7% worldwide. Not all Islamic fundamentalists or Islamicists will ever pick up a gun. So let me say that. Not all of them will. And if it can help you a little bit in regards to this, for them, the key issue is we want a See, I had it here. We want a social, political Muslim society. Do you know of Christians who have a social, political agenda? Does that mean that they will pick up a gun? If you're in Texas, okay, yeah. Some of you guys are laughing late. You're from Canada. Okay. A social political society. That's going to be the response. If we could just end up with this social political response, this is going to be the fast track to be able to get things under control again. So they reject nationalism, and they would say, no, we are not Pakistani. We are not Iranian. So when the Ayatollah Khomeini came in 1979, as the Shah was ousted out of Iran, actually fled, he came in, he kissed the tarmac at the airport, and he never recognized Iran. He said, this is the home of Islam. In fact, he rejected Islam, or nationalism, and for him it was a pan-Islamic world that he wanted to see established. So it was rejection of nationalism, secularism, communism, westernization. These are the evils that are in the world. These are the ones that are causing all kinds of problems. I've been reading an interesting book, The Princeton Readings of Islamic Thought, Text and Context from Al-Banna to Bin Laden. And we go back, and we'll show at another point, but beginning with Afghani in the 1600s, this thought was beginning to germinate. They began talking about it, started writing about it, and saying that there is a problem in the Muslim world, and there is decadence in the Muslim world. There is all kinds of, we've lost our sense as to who we are. There is rampant corruption in every aspect of society. And what we need to do is to gain control of this. And the best way to do this is by a political establishment. So what they want are Islamic values, institution, and counter-distinction to the Western world. They want an Islamic state. The Islamic state, like I said, was defunct by the end of the 6th, 7th century. So since then, there's been a problem. And they've been looking for some kind of answer in regards to this. They've been looking for a true Islamic state. And beginning with Afghani and others, they have been looking and dreaming and saying that this is what we want. In Islam, the kingdom of God is on earth. Within Christian thought, it is the kingdom of God is here, but not yet. George Eldon Ladd. But for them, it's the kingdom of God that they're looking to be established here. And it all goes back to what has been historically taking place. I've read an excellent book written by an Islamic scholar out of Lebanon. And he traces the morphing of Muhammad from early writings to present day. And Muhammad has become sort of the great Sufi leader. He became a great moralist. He became all of these things until the last couple of centuries, he has become greater than God himself. You can insult God, but if you insult the Prophet or the Quran, then there will be consequences. They've created a utopian understanding of the past. And probably one of the greatest problems is because they don't understand sin. What Mike had talked about earlier. So this whole utopian understanding has been driving this whole perspective. We are trying to chase this utopian reality that never really existed. which has been talked about in literature for many centuries now, so that their understanding of what Muhammad is as being sinless and perfect was not what Muslims wrote about early on. So the groups that they are, it's like the Salafiyas, so the Brotherhood, Jamaat Islamiyah, Hezbollah, ISIS, Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, you have all of these groups. They oppose Muslims that are secular, national, liberal, modernist, westernized, as well as even some of the Puritans. They're trying to bring about what they have lost. The Puritans, what they want to do is to get back to the time of Muhammad and his beliefs. For them, quite interestingly, they are concerned about theological matters. Does anyone here know of Christians that are concerned about theological matters? We have Greg, who is the one who is sitting on the theological matters for the Evangelical Free Church. But yes, theology matters. Correct belief does matter. They wanted to get rid of all kinds of things. And within the Muslim world, there has been an increase in Sufi belief. You go to Pakistan, you go to Iran, you go to so many of the places in the Muslim world. There are shrines to saints all over the place. And people will go to these places and these shrines, and they will bring their sick, and they believe that somehow they can get a blessing, and there will be a healing to take place with their own children or themselves. They will come and anything that is holy, whether these saints, it could be towels they were talking about, being in the shadow of somebody. Does this sound familiar? The Apostle Paul? Jesus? If only they would touch me, or if only if I could touch them. So they would take and hold the Quran and kiss it because they believe that there's going to be some kind of blessing that comes from this. And then these people that are looking at theology, they're saying, wait a minute, what does this have to do with Islam? We've got to get rid of this. And Wahhab talked about this, and he then coupled with the Saudi family and ended up with Wahhabism. And their idea is to get rid of all of these un-Islamic practices of amulets and everything else that they do that is not a part of Islam. We've got to get rid of all of this. We've got to be back to sort of the theological basis. And so they're really concerned about the saints, saint worship, magic, Sufi practices. All of this are innovations or what is called bidad. And they are the literalists. So they say that, you know, this is what it says, this is what it is, I believe it, and that's the way it is. So it's the Wahhabis. And they would be against the Shiites, the Mu'tazilites, the Sufis, the Muslim Orientalist innovators, and anyone who's liberal or talks about ijtihad. We'll talk about that a little bit later. It just means innovations. Then you have the traditionalists. They believe that they have been, there's really actually nothing new. Much like Judaism, commentaries are written on commentaries that are written on commentaries that are written on commentaries. So also in the Muslim world, there were commentaries written on commentaries that were written on commentaries that were written on commentaries. And by the time of Al-Ghazali in 1111, finally the Islamic leaders, the traditionalists, they just said, wait a minute, what all has been said has been said. There can be nothing new said under the sun. You can't continue on reinventing new things. So they closed the door to ijtihad, which is creative thinking in the Muslim world, by 1111. So from 1111 onwards, the educational system has now been stymied. No new thought, no new inventions, nothing new. And these traditionalists had put a stop to this, and there had been a downward decline happening from that point on. They want to uphold the pre-modern schools of Islamic law. We go back to the early church fathers. They go back to the early church fathers of Islam, and that's where they get your opinions. But these opinions happen to be in a tribal community dealing with tribalism and not in regards to issues of today. So they uphold the solutions of the pre-modern jurists and theologians. So they say, well, you know, what we need to do is start to cut people's hands off because that's what it says in the Quran. We've got to be literal about it. And we have proof because of these commentaries that were written in the early period of time that had that kind of perspective. So they reject the reforms and criticism of Islamic law. They dominate all of the traditional seminary systems across the Muslim world. It's because of this that when Sisi became president of Egypt, he went to Al-Azhar University, which is the Trinity, if I can use it from the Evangelical Free Church standpoint, rather than Oxford or some of these other places. You have to realize we're talking contextually here. He went to these scholars and these teachers at Al-Azhar and said, you guys are the problem the way that you're interpreting the Quran. You are the ones that are causing all of this problem and carnage in the world. You have to stop. And you have to change the way you are teaching the Quran to all of these students who go to all of these institutions around the world. And then he shut down 90 mosques in Egypt because they were not conforming unto what's going on. Now, if you can remember, what are people thinking now of Sisi? Who are you to tell me how to interpret the Quran? Who are you to tell me how to interpret these things? But he's trying to correct a system that has been so messed up. So there are the groups. Most Muslims fit into this category. So that anyone who opposes reform, which is called ijtihad, modernist, neo-modernist, Western-educated scholars and liberals, they are the bad guys, according to this position. But I think as religious leaders of the Evangelical Free Church, you might resonate with some of this type of thefts as they're trying to wrestle to find out what's going on. Let me just say this. We have a foundation upon which we can build our faith. They have sand. Scholarship that is coming on right now, archaeologists are finding out that really Mecca did not exist during the time of Muhammad. Right now there's a tremendous modernization that's going on, rebuilding of Mecca, particularly around the mosque. As they have been digging out all of these things, they're finding no archaeological evidence of anything underneath. The early mosques for the first century all pointed towards Petra, not Mecca. The description of Mecca in the Quran does not match Mecca today. All of the writings that they look to are 200 years to 300 years after Muhammad, and it appears in the Persian world, not in the Arab world. So the foundations here are much different, and they're struggling in the midst of all of the sand to understand where do we find and where do we come down in regards to all of this. There is the ijtihadist and modernists, and they're the ones that are in favor of reopening the door of creative interpretation. Let me just say this. It's the Shias that never closed the door to creative thinking. It's been the Sunnis that are 80% of the Muslim world that did. So these are the ones, they would argue for major change in methodology of Islamic law and reform. They say we have to have a modern version of Islam because the current version that we have been taught does not exist and cannot exist in the modern world. Islamic law needs to be substantially changed to meet the needs of Muslims today. The traditional law and Islamic law is just not relevant. There needs to be new law. So as I told you about my friend, he teaches Islam at an institution in Chicago. And he has told me flat out, we have to write a new Quran. We can't look at it the way that we have in the past. We have to discover the true Muhammad. We have to try to discover the true Islam and get rid of all of this other stuff that is smoke and mirrors. Let's find the true Muhammad. But if we're looking at scholarship, as many of the new researchers are looking at, the question is yes, Muhammad is the real person, but the Muhammad of the Hadith and of the Sirah comes way past the time of Muhammad. And some of the scholars are saying the Muhammad that they have created in history was to justify practices that were going on at that time. So they would oppose the traditionalists, the Islamists, and some of the Puritans. Here is one who is from Minnesota, a Muslim. And then this is Al-Fadi, who has been the advisor to three of our presidents in regards to Islam. And he falls into this modernist, ijtihadist mentality. And that is why you heard the phrase that Islam is peace. He was the one that was orchestrating that and saying, really, this is the true spirit of Islam. Then you have secularists. These secularists are Western educated. They are elites. They see his faith as being a personal faith. They value personal piety. There's really no need for an Islamic state or implementation of Sharia. They think that that's really backward. So they oppose that. There is actually an institution of secularization of the Islamic society. You can look it up and type it into your web browser and you will find that they're doing seminars all over in the United States. There's a society. In fact, a friend of mine has a website which is called exmuslim.com, and these secularists have come to him and say, give us your URL because we want that because that is who we are. We're ex-Muslims, and we want to get all the ex-Muslims together. And he goes, nope, I'm a Christian, and I'm not going to give you my whole thing. Come on over to my side. So they are looking at democracy and talking about it. What's most interesting is this man up here, Tariq Ramadan. He is the grandson of Hassan al-Banna, who was killed in Egypt because of his interpretation and implementation of Islamic law and seeking to have military control. And he's one of the fathers of the Islamic fundamentalist movement worldwide. So a lot of yours that are doing suicide bombings, his writings of his grandfather are the ones that they're reading. He's in Switzerland, and Notre Dame asked him to come on faculty. He sent his wife and children, they enrolled in American schools and everything. And then the U.S. State Department looked at him and said, ah, your grandfather was Hassan al-Banna. We're not too sure. We don't think that you are good. And therefore, they rejected his visa. So he stayed in Switzerland. But he's one of these modernists who are really trying to say, okay, let's develop an Islam that fits the modern world. And therefore, our politics has really come in. So anyone calling for an Islamic state, social political order, and seeking to implement the pre-Islamic schools, they object and object to it. Tariq Ramadan has a heart, a big voice, and many Muslims are looking to him as an answer to Western society. And he has written books on Islam in the Western society. African-American Islam, did you know that 40% of all Muslims in the United States are African-American? And you thought probably Arab, but no, they're African-American. There's the Sunni category, and then there's the Nation of Islam. It's most interesting, this man that is over here, his father was the founder, or one of the founders of the Nation of Islam, and he discovered true Islam, and when he did, he rejected the Nation of Islam and wanted to have a really African version of Islam, and he started his own society. But he found that most of these African Americans who became Muslims, they preached more from the Bible than they did the Quran. They had choirs and gospel singing in the mosques rather than what you're not supposed to have. It was music within the mosques. And he got so frustrated that he withdrew and just said, I'm leaving this whole society I've started and I'm just going to do my own thing. In fact, his organization that he started has now just disappeared. So now there's just Sunni African Americans and Nation of Islam Muslims. And the Nation of Islam one is not doing well at all. Louis Farrakhan has got cancer. And you don't hear him much at all. But there are these, also within the African-American community, there's been this search of who are we, what are our roots, where do we come from? And the lie they've been told is that it's been slave, that you were Muslims, but you became Christians by slave traders. The fact of the matter is that actually it was the Muslims that gave them Muslim names. And it was the Muslims that did the slave trade in Africa. And they did it among Africans. And then the Westerners came and said, oh, this is a good way of doing it. And so they got in onto the slave trade. The biggest problem is that the majority of Muslims were sent to the Arab world, not to the New World. But there's no progeny of these because what they did is they castrated the males and many of them died in transit. And the women were used in harems. It's an untold thing, particularly within the African-American community as to what was happening. There are the mystic Muslim Sufis. Their whole thing is this inner spiritual life in response to modernity. They've looked only back into themselves and say that let us become God. I was in a Bible study with a couple of weeks ago, and one of the guys, he was saying, I am God, I am God, I am God, you know, this whole Sufi type of thing, and this connection to God. It was kind of an interesting Bible study. But they love God. Their poetry is about God. I took my pastor to the mosque, which was half mile from the church, and he didn't know it existed. So he went in for the mosque service, and it was an Albanian mosque, and Albanians tend to be Sufi. And during the sermon, he heard about the love of God, and he turned to me and he said, I thought Muslims didn't talk about the love of God. And he says, yes, they do talk about the love of God. Particularly this version of Islam talks an awful lot about it. And if you read Rumi and others, you will see this incredible literature written about love of God. The difference is, it is the lover pursuing the lover pursuing the one that loves rather than God pursuing us. So they're trying to get a hold of God. They're trying to express to God of the love that they have for him so that God would recognize them. So this is their response, to which we say, no, God's been pursuing you. God wants to pursue you so that you can know him. So things have been changed, but this mystical union with the divine. I had one guy, and we were doing showing the Jesus film, and he said, stop the film, I want to become a Christian. So we said, no, sit down, let's just get done with this film. And we get done with the film. We ask him, okay, what do you want? He said, I want to accept Jesus in my life. So we pull him into the back room. We talk to him. We ask him all kinds of questions. We lead him through the sinner's prayer. He said, is this what you want to do? Yes, it is. And he accepts Christ. Oh, I'm a Christian. He goes and runs into the room to the other people and said, I'm a Christian. A week later, I came to his house and his apartment and said, what happened last week? And he said, well, I became a Christian. I said, okay, good. Who's Jesus? Is he a prophet? Is he God? Is he a good man? Just who is Jesus? Well, he's not God, and he's more than a good man. He's a prophet. So the question becomes, what did he accept? Come to find out, he has this entire Sufi understanding in which you accept each prophet into your life. Until you get to the last prophet, and then you become absorbed into the one becoming divine yourself. So I think that one of the things we need to understand as we do this type of evangelism, that not to always accept just what was going on, but we need to ask and understand what's happening, because it depends where they are coming from. So there's all kinds of associations of Sufism, the Nashkabandis and others, the Gulen movement, in Turkey. He lives in the Poconos, self-exiled from Turkey. And it's a good thing because he'd be dead by now. But there's this feud going on between Ergun and Gulen. There are the refugees. They've been displaced, disenfranchised. Nothing is normal. Trust has been broken by government, news agencies, ideologies, and religions. And they're having a real hard time. And religion is sort of home, but there's a lot of other things that are really on their mind. And we don't need to categorize them into that. Then there's 80% of Muslims fall into this folk religion, popular type of thing. In the Muslim world, dreams and visions are extremely important. So the mosque in Northbrook, just south of Deerfield, I went there with a group of students, and the imam there said that before he makes any decision in the mosque, what he does is he emails his Sufi master, who is in the Mediterranean Sea area, of what he has to decide on. He will then print out this email from the imam, and he will put it under his pillow, have a nocturnal dream. In the morning, he wakes up, he writes out what this nocturnal dream is and its interpretation, sends it back to him in Northbrook, and then that is what he bases his decision on. Anyone who is in business will not make a business deal without a nocturnal dream to tell them what to do and what not to do. Paul Hebert talks about the forgotten middle of the spirit world. We live in a scientific age in which this middle world does not exist almost. We give sort of a slight hand to it, but we don't really live in this world and understand it. But this group of Muslims, that world is very real. Can you understand why so many Muslims are seeing dreams and visions of Jesus? If the unseen world breaks into the seen world through dreams and visions, God says, I've done this before. Paul, Joseph, Daniel, we have multiple examples where God has done this. So for this worldview, this becomes a very important thing. I'd like to talk about this. This is important. Using Wallace's revitalization model and applying it to Islam, we start with the Islamic steady state from 632 to 1111, when we talked about Al-Ghazali closing the door of creative thinking. Then, and this is true for every religious organization, every business, every country, this whole revitalization cycle is what it goes through. So usually this is where the founder is, and you would follow the founder's type of thing. But then when the children come along, there's going to be an increased stress that comes of dissidence, of things growing further and further apart. So from 1111 to 1850, there is a growing dissidence, and that's when Afghani started to write these things and saying, here's some problems with our world, and we're seeing that everything is going away. We've lost our sense. We've lost our identity. We've lost who we've become. So more of these writers start writing, and we now come to 1850s to around September 11th, if you will. And there is the Salafia movement, there's the Wahhabis, and there's been that sort of a mixing of the two together, and this has been morphing. And there's greater dissidence that is taking place within the community, and it is getting to a point of crisis. So now we end up into the 2000s, and we see ISIS, terrorism. The biggest questions Muslims are dealing with is, what do we do with religious pluralism? What do we do with pluralism in the world? We've been isolated, in which we were only ourselves. Now the rest of the world has come crashing into our world. How do we live? Who are we? How do we do this in our world? So they are at a point of absolute crisis. And here's where every business, every institution needs to then ask this question. If we do nothing, we then end, and as we close churches. Because what they did at the Founding Fathers doesn't seem to work anymore. And we haven't changed, and this dissidence has grown, and you then end up with the death of it, or you rediscover who you are. But Islam really can't do that because their faith is built on sand. These voices are trying their best to say, who are we and how do we make it? They are lost without Christ. Absolutely lost without Christ. And there are Muslims that are rejecting Islam and becoming secularist. Iran is reported that 80% of Iranians have become secular. 80%. This process of secularization, and they are looking at what is happening, and they're saying, if this is what Islam is, I want no part of it. And they have said, well, who is doing things? Early on, in the 80s and 90s, they looked and said, it was communists, and it was the West. We don't like the West, we'll go with the communists. And then the Berlin Wall and communism went through a really dark time. So they're looking to the West and they say, what is the number one thing in the West? And you know what they see? Materialism. And they said, that must be what it is. Let me get to Hollywood. Let me get to America. So many of them want to go here because they live in a place where corruption, poverty, and inability to get anything economically, because usually it's between 40 to 60% unemployment. So the West is the answer. So the question becomes, where is the church? Where will be the church in this crisis? Will we hide? Will we give in to fear? Will we demonize? We will accept people who will feed our fears? Or will we look with compassion, like Jesus looking on the crowd and with compassion and say, well, we got to feed them? The global crisis has increased the stress level within the worldwide Muslim community. Some of the literature is distinctly anti-Western and apologetic in nature. I'll give you that. Many Muslims are victims of Islamic agenda. More Muslims are killed by Muslims. I was at a mosque in Chicago, the MCC. There was an imam that had come in from Egypt, and his sermon was, "We have to stop killing our own people. We have to stop killing everybody else." His entire sermon was, "We are the problem." And he said, "The West is not the problem. We're the problem, and we're killing ourselves." And he had no answer. So where are we? Because this crisis of Islam is here. And more Muslims are becoming open to talking if we would just reach across the aisle and talk. So we need to be a loving body of Christ. We need to receive those who are victims of Islamic violence. It's sad to allow so much of our policies and government be dictated by fear. We need to pray for our Muslim neighbors. I have only had one Muslim in 33 years reject prayer. Most of them say, "Could you pray for me?" And they'd say, "Your God answers prayer." We need to resist reducing Islam and Muslims to an ideology that we attack. That is the worst thing in the world. We need to share Christ with those who are just willing to listen. And if we don't, then what we see will continue and get worse because the light has been put under a bushel. So we need to be a city on a hill, shining. And I find Muslims very happy when you'd identify yourself as a Christian rather than fuzzy trying to be something that you're not, because then they have no idea where to place you. And it's not that they hate us. They just want to know who they're talking to. So let's present Christ.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the EFCA Theology Podcast. You can find more episodes by searching EFCA Theology Podcast in any podcast app or on the web at efca.org/podcast. Thank you.